Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. This episode of Everyone Loves Guitar is brought to you by Taylor Guitars and their new Grand Pacific Round Shoulder Dreadnought. Powered by Taylor's breakthrough V-Class bracing system, the Grand Pacific gives you a warm, seasoned sound with clear low-end power and notes that are stronger, longer sustaining, and more in tune with each other all the way up the fretboard. Make sure you check it out online at taylorguitars.com, then go out and play one today. That's the new Grand Pacific at TaylorGuitars.com. Did you know if your instrument or any of your gear is damaged, broken, or stolen outside your homeowner's insurance policy will not cover any of it? That's right. Homeowner's insurance only pays if something happens inside your home. But Music Pro Insurance insures all your music gear, no matter where it is, anywhere in the world, even when you check it in as baggage on an airline. Here, let me give you some examples. Let's say you're in a car accident and your equipment is damaged, you're covered. Your kid pours apple juice into your amplifier, covered. Someone spills beer all over your pedal board at a gig somewhere across the world, boom, you're covered. Any kind of theft or accidental damage is covered, even water damage from hurricanes and breakage from earthquakes. But here's what makes Music Pro really different. They're not going to argue with you over the value of your instrument or make you run around looking for receipts when it comes time to paying your claim. They know exactly why your vintage instrument is worth 10 times more than a new one. Plus, all claims are typically paid and fully settled in 24 to 48 hours. So if your equipment is not insured properly, go to musicproinsurance.com, hit standard, then enter your information and get a free gear protection estimate. Don't be that player who ignores this, and then next month when something happens, you're wondering why you didn't take 10 minutes to do this properly. Make sure you go to musicproinsurance.com, enter your information, and get a free gear protection estimate. If something happens, you will be thanking me. Trust me on this. musicproinsurance.com. The Be Fulfilled Journal helps you be more honest with yourself and with others and be more open to handling things you've avoided dealing with for years. It's a 12-week online and journal program that helps you identify and eliminate things you do that are causing you stress and live in more gratitude and joy. It was actually developed by a long-term friend of mine who got sober in 2008, and he's put together a great deal just for my listeners. You get the 300-page hardcover journal and access to the 12-week video program online, plus free shipping, plus membership in a private Facebook support group with others going through the program, plus a 5-day mini course showing you how to let go of stuff that's draining your energy, plus a 30-day 100% money-back guarantee. To start your journey and get all the bonuses, go to befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. That's befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, this is Craig, and I just want to talk to you about something serious for a moment before we start today's episode. In 2018, at the very beginning of the year in January, I had interviewed Frank Sidoris. Frank was and still is Slash's guitar player. He's a lovely guy, really cool, and just a tremendous guitar player. And I actually had a lot of fun with Frank, and he's one of those guys we've stayed in touch throughout this time. And last week, I read some really unfortunate news on his social media channels that his girlfriend has cervical cancer. And I don't know if you have had a family member or had cancer impact your life or your family's life or a friend's life, but I have. And it's a terribly devastating disease in every single way, and the sense of powerlessness that you feel when a loved one has cancer is really devastating. Anyway, Frank's girlfriend, I do not believe, has any kind of medical insurance. He is running a GoFundMe campaign, and I just wanted to tell you about the campaign if you are inclined to go donate, make a donation. I know Frank and his girlfriend would appreciate it. And I just wanted to give you the location of where you could find that campaign. The best thing to do is go to Frank's socials, and his Instagram and Twitter is both at Frank Sidoris, and his name is Frank, FrankSidoris. And you can also find it on his Facebook page, which is facebook.com/ Frank Sidoris. Again, FrankSidoris. Any little bit you're willing to give will help those guys out. And I'm just going to run this message for this week to help Frank and his family out. And whether you've been impacted by cancer or not, I certainly thank you for listening to this, and I wish you nothing but good health. So now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. Today, we're going to show some love because even keyboard players need to get on this show. And we got one of the best, both in talent in terms of what a great guy he is. I'm with the one and only Ed Roth. You may not be familiar with Ed's name, but certainly everybody in LA is. You've definitely heard him play. He's toured, recorded, or been the music director with the Brothers Johnson, Annie Lennox, Taylor Dane, Ronnie Montrose, Robbie Krieger, Keith Emerson, Glenn Hughes, Rob Halford, Chad Smith, rapper Coolio, and loads of others. Like, I really had to skim this down. He's a first call keyboard session player in LA. He's got two solo jazz albums of his own, Ed Roth, which was released in 2012, and The Mad Beatnik, released in 2016, delivering two top 10 iTunes jazz singles in Europe, 500,000 streams of the hit song Blue from his first record, and The Mad Beatnik featured Tom Scott on sax and Chad Smith on drums and was number 25 on iTunes Jazz in the U.S. He's got a brand new record out called Jazzland, and we'll talk about that later. And let's see. He records, he's also does a ton of in-studio session work at his own Glendale, California studio, which is called The Keyboard Room. And he does a lot of composing and scoring for film and TV, and he's a funny guy. So, Ed, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Hey, what was the first kind of music you listened to at home? Because this is a good story.
You know, I was in a strict Brazilian household, and I had not even heard rock, I don't think, until I was 12.
Wow.
We could only hear either Brazilian music, which is mostly bossa novas, was what my mom liked, and classical. That's all I heard. So then, when they went to sleep, I would put on headphones and listen to what I liked, which was Howard University Radio, which was great jazz and R&B, funky stuff. And I had no idea what I was listening to. I just liked it.
That's like a black college in D.C. or just outside of D.C. maybe?
Yeah, it's in D.C.
It's one of the top schools in the country.
I played there, I want to say, 2 years ago with Shuggy Otis.
That's so funny.
And the neighborhood has changed. It's gentrified, as they say, which is maybe not such a good thing, but it is what it is. Anyway, they had that station. Yeah, it was R&B station. That's what it was. You never heard rock.
Played there with Shuggy Otis. That's funny, man.
Oh, shit. Never a dull moment with Shuggy Otis. It's that later.
What was like your mom was just really strict, like in general, like about everything or just for your music or?
You know, they were kind of strict, and then my mom got sick as I was a little older, and then I was just kind of free to do whatever I wanted. But how do I put it? Some parents are, they want to support whatever it is their kid wants to do, which, yeah, I get that. My parents were more like, if that's what you want to do, good luck. Go ahead and do it, but you got to do it on your own, which I think honestly forced me to really do it. Not go, you know, I didn't go to music school. I didn't go putz around at a school or decide what style of music I was going to play or any of that. I just had to go out and work.
Right.
So I took whatever gig came along, and I think it really it forced me to play all kinds of different styles, respect all different kind of styles. And kind of because I didn't have time to sit there and go, you know, I'm going to transcribe this solo of 5 Bill Evans songs note for note. Because I didn't do that. I kind of just learned what I learned through my ear, and I kind of played by like me, for better or for worse.
right from the beginning. That's really cool.
Yeah. You wind up with your own sound, and sometimes it's good and sometimes not so much.
Yeah. Well, I think it worked in your case, man. So you grew up in DC, and when did you move to LA, and what prompted you to move there?
First I went to Texas, but you know, I should maybe share my young gig story.
Yeah, man.
I'd been playing, you know, I was, I think 14. I started playing little parties and, you know, just, I think school dances, whatever. And then when I was 15, I got in some local band, and the next youngest guy was like a butcher at the local grocery store. I think he was like 21 or so. But I thought they were the greatest thing. And my mom would drop me off at the gig and have a little sack dinner. And the first place I was playing, we had a regular gig at the Branding Iron House of Beef. And I had no idea what that meant. You know, it had the saloon doors, and I'm looking at the place, and you know, when you're that age, you think you know everything. And I'm looking at the mirrors that are only neck high, and I'm going, something strange here. One day my mom drops me off early, and I find out that it's a strip club by day and rock and roll at night. I was like, this is great.
Oh, my gosh.
Come early every time.
That's so awesome.
That was my first real gig in a club.
That's so funny, strip club by day. You know what? I have been in so few strip clubs in my life, to be honest. I didn't even get it when you said the mirrors are up here. I think I've been in like two or three times, maybe. I'm like totally not familiar with that. Okay.
Strip club is like a safe haven when you're now not so much, but in the old days it would be a safe haven on the road, right? If you're playing in Oklahoma and you got hair halfway down your back, you know, you're gonna get into a little squab. Somebody's gonna start a fight. But if you just want to have a drink and peaceful, you go to a strip club and play pool.
And no one's going to bother you.
Nobody bothers you. You can drink your drink, blah, blah, blah.
Interesting, man. Yeah, that's wild. L.A., when'd you move? And what prompted you to move there?
I was in a band in Dallas. The last one was called Dirty Blonde. I'd been in Houston and Dallas. And there were some strangely great musicians, especially in Houston. You just get to a point where it's just such a small little world. And, you know, I wish I could say I planned it and I read some book about the music business. That's where you got to be. It wasn't that at all. The sound man for the band was like, you know, everything happens in LA and I'm going to move to LA. And I thought, well, I didn't have a pot to piss in, so I might as well not have a pot to piss in LA. So I caught a ride out with him. Checked it out for 2 weeks, went back to Texas, packed up my stuff. I think whatever hoopty jalopy I had then blew up, bought another car for a big $175, a 75 wow. Plymouth Fury, put everything I own, came to LA, and it's definitely a shock when you see how many great players there are everywhere. Playing every kind of music, you're like, oh shit. I mean, maybe not as you don't see them as much now because there isn't much of a local scene, but back then it was like, you know, I needed a gig. I got to LA, I want to say Christmas Eve in the morning.
What year was
I want to say it's 86, I'm guessing 86 or 87. I'm bad with time. And I went to a place called the Musicians Contact Service. Sterling Howard, I forget Robert's last name. And I went there and sure enough, I got a New Year's gig right away.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, the New Year's gig was an awakening of what was in store. We rehearsed at a boys club. It's funny what you remember. And it was some corporate band and you had to wear these bad outfits. And you changed in between sets. And I remember, again, funny what you remember. I'm going, there's something funky. And I'm like, wow, you know, I took a shower. Did I forget to put deodorant on? And I'm sniffing the shirt. And then I see the other guys in the band are doing the same thing. And they hadn't washed the shirts. There were these god-awful baseball uniforms. They were funky as hell. And like two guys were session players doing this bad gig because, you know, you got to work all the time.
Yeah.
So that was a that was an LA awakening, but I kind of lucked into into gigs. I mean, the first real gig I got in LA was through, well, rewinding a second, I played reggae in Houston with some guys, and those guys had all moved to LA in front of me. So I played with them for a while, and okay. I was doing a backyard barbecue with them. I mean, some random thing, not even in the city. And the sound man's best friend was Jane Child's manager.
Holy shit.
Yeah, Jane Child's probably before your time, a little bit.
A little
she
bit.
She had that, the chain going from the nose to the ear.
I know exactly. Yeah, I know exactly who. She was not bad looking, if I remember correctly.
She's beautiful.
Yeah, right.
Very,
yeah.
Very nice lady.
Yeah.
So she had just done a record, and they wanted to make her rock. So it was a rock record. The first record, she had some hits. And, you know, this management company called me and said, hey, you know what? You got referred, blah, blah, blah. Come in and play. I came in and played. They're like, wow, we like your thing, your vibe, blah, blah, blah. We don't have retainer, but how about we put you with this other artist, Mark Bonilla?
I know
who is, who is under the, I think it was the manager's best friend managed Mark, or somehow they were connected. And I hadn't heard of Mark. And I'm still kind of the R&B guy. And they're like, oh, he's a shredder. I'm like, oh, really? Well, okay. Then they told me what the gigs paid. And I was like, this is great. I love it. And Mark turned out to be a great guy. Yeah. He, in turn, he didn't do a ton of gigs, but he was the music director for the big radio station, rock station, KLOS in LA. And he was playing on, I guess, their Christmas show, and they would have a house band, and the house band was, you know, was crack guys. The old MD still played. It was Steve Lukather was the old MD. It was Lee Sklar on bass.
Oh my God.
Greg Bissonette on drums. The house keyboard player was Steve Porcaro.
Wow. They had a B,
yeah. They had a B3 there and, you know, nice gear, whatever. And I'm noodling on the B3. And Steve comes up and says, hey, man, you sound great. How come you're only playing on these two songs? I said, you know, I don't know. I guess it's just a feature with the artist. He goes, well, he's the MD. You should be playing more. I'm like, yeah, you know, it's his game. Whatever. So Steve goes, now you're going to play more. I got to make some phone calls. Play with Eddie Money. I'm sure you know these songs and hear the charts. And he just left. So I'm in the rehearsal room and I start playing. And no one notices till the second song that it's changed. And at that point, when we take a break, the two DJs come over and say, oh, you must be the new guy, blah, blah, blah. I'm Mark Thompson, blah, blah, blah. And Mark has wound up being a good friend over the years. And that's how I got in that. And Mark Bonilla was nice enough to go, oh, well, obviously he can play this stuff. So let me call him on all the stuff I do.
Wow.
What happened with that? Everybody on the show. Well, a lot of guys on the show, Glenn Hughes, I wound up doing 7 records with Glenn. I met him on the show. Hilarious guy and one of the greatest singers of all time. And
yeah, great
good
voice.
Guy. So I played with him. I met him on the show. I met Ronnie Montrose on the show. And I played with him from when I met him and until he died. He great friend, great mentor. I met Rob Halford. I don't know if I met Rob on the show. I think Rob was through Roy Z. But anyway, that was how I got a lot of gigs. And that's how I started playing rock, because I didn't know any of the rock guys. I just kind of fell into it.
Wow. Isn't it amazing? Like, I'm always shocked at the serendipity of how things in this business particularly goes.
You know, if you can play and you're not a tool, you tend to... You kind of tend to do okay. I mean, the rock session thing was even weirder. I don't even know how I met Joe Holmes. I don't know if you know him. He played guitar for Ozzy for a minute. He's one of the greatest players, rock players for that style that just exists. Organic, but with a lot of chops. Really nice guy. He was trying to do his own band thing. And somehow I met him, and they were like, you know, it was the days of the glam hair rock. So you wouldn't be on stage. But I think I did one show with him, and there was a producer named Jim Faraci who was working with them for a minute. And he did a lot of people. He did Rat, Poison, Rhino Bucket, a lot of those 80s bands. And I met Jim and Faraci, and he goes, "Man, you play great. Can you play in all keys?" And I said, "That's a strange question. I'm a musician. I mean, R&B, you got to play with horn sections. So you got to play in B flat and E flat. And if you play jazz, you have to play in every key. Song will be in four or five keys, whatever. You got to, you know." So I was like, "Yeah, I can." He goes, "Okay, great." What would happen, they would have these hair bands and they would all have a keyboard player. But he couldn't necessarily play really well. And a lot of cats, you'd be surprised, I call them white key wizards. They can only play in a handful of keys. And when they can't play in another key, they transpose the keyboard. Well, that's all well and good when it's a keyboard. But when you're trying to do a piano ballad, there's no button you can push.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
So I would do one song. They'd always have a piano ballad. And Jim started calling me for a lot of stuff he did. And then Roy Z called me. I don't know if you know him. No. Lovely guy. He produced a couple Halford records and Bruce Dickinson records. He's played on a lot of stuff. And he had a band called Tribe of Gypsies. And Roy is actually the guy that got me with Rob Halford. But it's just so strange. You know, you think of music as one thing and how you're going to get a gig, and really it has nothing to do with it. You don't get it on auditions. I mean, maybe some cats do, but I didn't.
You got it by getting out there and then just doing a good job and it's being in traffic and then getting referred.
Yeah. Trying to do a good job. I mean, you know, when I visited LA, the sound man, the guy from this band, was one of those guys that would read books about everything. And he would find out who the mover and shaker was. So he found some hotshot music attorney that he took to lunch and paid him for his time to get advice. And I remember the guy goes, you know, the sound man asked him all these questions. And at the end, you know, I got in one word. He let me go to lunch. I go, "Hey, any suggestions?" He goes, "Just become a part of the scene." And I thought, what a douche. That's what you're going to tell me? Really? Seriously? That's your advice? And you know what? Spot on.
Yeah. Just get out there and do it and be a musician.
Yeah. If you can play well, if you take all the gigs you can get, the cats that you come up with on these horrible initial gigs, I mean, some of these little bar gigs, the guys I played with, man, they were top calls. They're still friends of mine today. They're still guys that I play with when I can. You know, we're still tight. I mean, I was telling you about Phil Chin taking pictures. I met Phil Chin on some reggae gigs. He's an amazing reggae player. You know, we did sessions together over the years, but we never did anything major. And then a few years ago, I got a call to start playing with Robbie Krieger, and Phil is Robbie's bass player.
What, so were you down here? Man, I saw Robbie down here with my son. It was the weirdest thing. I was randomly, of all times, I need to look at some concerts here. I don't know why. And I look and I popped up in a small hall in St. Pete, Capitol Theater, maybe.
You know, I don't do the mall. There's another cat that I split the gig with, and there's a bunch of other stuff I do, but I love Robbie. He's a great player. He's a great musician, and he always wants to play. So you'll see him in some weird settings. I mean, how do I put it? You see a lot of these bands where there's one or two guys that own the name, and then there's another version of the band.
Yeah, totally.
Where it's like it's three quarters of the band, and it's what's really the band, but they don't have the name.
Right.
And the group with the name works all the time. Robbie, I think there's some legal thing where he doesn't use the name The Doors or something. I mean, Robbie is The Door.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now there's only him and John Densmore left anyway. So it's, but I couldn't, and I sat in second row center for $20 a ticket. And I had my son with me, and it was like, you know, more probably than anybody I've ever seen in my life, seeing him was just amazing because of the impact he had on me. You know, maybe if I sat second row in a little club with David Gilmour, that might have been the only other thing that would have kind of freaked me or moved me like that. I mean, this is Robbie Krieger. The guy had like helped change rock and roll, man.
Well, he wrote a lot of those tunes. Morrison wrote a lot of the lyrics.
The lyrics, yeah.
Robbie wrote a lot of the music, and he still brings it when he plays. I mean, he looks a little rough. I love him dearly. He looks a little rough now, but he's in great shape.
Yeah,
he's
in good shape. He's slim.
Plays his ass off. Yeah. He'll sit and play for 2.5 hours if you'll let him. He'll make the set that long. He doesn't want to stop. If he's having fun playing, he wants to play golf, play music, and that's kind of, you know, those are his top things, I think, and do charity gigs. He's a big charity gig guy, too.
Good for him.
Nice cat.
What was really funny is at the end, he said, hey, why don't you let me know what song you want to play on the count of three? And as soon as three hits, I screamed out, Light My Fire, of course, right? Nobody else said anything. I'm like, what? How it was like, you know, full auditorium. Like, how did nobody? I don't know if people are like feel awkward or, but shit, that's Robbie Krieger's asking me to ask him what song to play. You know, I mean, how many opportunities are going to get that in your lifetime, right? So it was an amazing show. It was great. My kid was there. You know, that was a good sort of bonding moment for us because we like the same music. But you know, to be there with him to see someone I got turned on to when I was younger than his age was just nice. You know, Robbie wouldn't know any of this, but it was a special thing. You know, that he delivered for us that night. So
that's great.
Sorry, man. I didn't mean to talk about myself.
No, just, that all was good.
A really nice memory with Robbie. Okay, so you talked about Montrose, Robbie. How about Maricela?
Maricela is a Mexican pop star. Very nice lady. Sometimes had habits that kind of affected her showing up to gigs or being on time or performing, but when she was together, devastatingly good. But what's interesting, nice lady too, just the wrong people around her. But that's the funny bit with that is where we played. A buddy of mine, Rica Benavides, who's no longer with us, which, you know, if I come on the show another time, I'll tell you the greatest practical joke ever pulled on me. But I don't want to kind of it's not quite mixed company yet. So he gets me on the gig and he goes, you know, I'm half Brazilian. My mom was Brazilian and most of my family that's left is there. So I'm half Latino. I'm half Latino, half Jewish, which is a crazy combination.
Do you speak Portuguese at all?
I'm sorry?
Do you speak Portuguese? In Brazil, yes, they speak Portuguese, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I speak fluent Portuguese. So I'm a Brazilian Jew. There are not a lot of us.
No.
Anyway, Rika's like, well, you know, you'll have fun. We did Brazilian gigs together in the scene in L.A., and they were always a blast, a lot of partying, a lot of craziness. So the big shows are in soccer stadiums and palenques, they call them. Now, the American artists and the international artists tend not to be doing those, but the Mexican artists play at palenques, which is a cockfight. But it's not a cockfight like you think of a little pit in the backyard. It's like it's up on the teleprompter, you know, and it's an all-day event and the whole family comes out and everybody's betting on it. So you already you've got a funny situation. You do a sound check and they take all the gear and they tear it back down. They don't mark anything. Then they roll out a carpet so that you're not playing on top of chicken feathers, guts, and blood.
Well, that's
so
nice.
At least you're not on that over the dirt. And they reset up the sound. And, of course, they're in a hurry. They haven't labeled it. So generally, you know, just sounds like ass. I mean, you can't hear anything you're doing. The monitors are always wrong. Fortunately, she was such a big star. People would just sing the chorus. The whole crowd would sing the choruses. And a lot of the verses wouldn't matter. So there was that, but where it really got interesting is the promoters that put it on. If they were laundering money or it was cartel people, you were lucky. because then there wouldn't be really any issues. They would just, you know, they would cough up the money and get you on stage. Because if you don't get paid before you play in South America, and sorry, nobody call me racist because I'm Latino. If you don't get paid before you get on stage on the smaller scale, you will not get paid.
Oh, so it's like, wow, Chuck Berry shit.
So it would turn, and paid in cash, so it would turn into this strange game of chicken where the promoter would try to push you onto the stage by saying that the crowd was about to riot, and they would wait till the last second till they were going to tear the place down. And the band would have to be, you know, we would have to hold firm and not go out there.
Wow.
So... yeah, I mean, on so many levels, it's funny. I came to be – people aren't hip to pro wrestling anymore, but back in the day –
Lucha Libre.
Yeah. Even in the States, though, you'd watch it on TV, and there was the guy in the mask.
Sure.
And the guy in the mask was the bad guy.
Right.
And for a time when I was in Dallas, I worked out at a gym where actually a lot of the pro wrestlers worked out. And, you know, you think of them as like they're not athletes. Trust me, they are. They used to throw me around like a beach ball if I didn't show up. But I met those guys. I got a taste of it. And suddenly I became the guy in the mask, because what they would do is they'd send the band out while she was getting ready. And at this point, the crowd's waited two and a half hours for the band, and they're pissed.
Oh, wow.
So they're booing you as you're going out. They're throwing shit. I mean, thank God they didn't allow beer in cans. They would just throw beer. I remember one time we were somewhere where they were throwing these cushions. They had seat cushions.
Holy crap.
And I'm thinking, these seat cushions don't hurt, you know. And then suddenly there's a mountain. When 20,000 people are throwing their seat cushions, you're up to your waist in seat cushions quickly.
So
just
wait a minute.
Kind of some, yeah. So those were the everyday show things.
And this was all to squeeze you guys, because to succumb to the pressure of going out to play, and therefore once you play, you didn't get paid. Too bad. You're bad. You lose.
Right. That's how it would work. And
wow.
Now the other problem was, a lot of the artists like to be laid down there. It's kind of like some weird kind of badge of honor. So sometimes she would be really late because she wanted to, other times because she was doing other things she shouldn't have been doing, whatever it is you want to say. A couple times they did riot. And it's a story for another day, but let's just say I survived three riots and got tossed in Mexican jail. So after that,
holy shit.
I'm afraid of very little.
Did you keep doing the gigs, or did you get to a point like, fuck this, I'm done?
When I got tossed in jail, even then I did the gigs, and then the money got funny. And once that happened, when I had to chase down my cake, then I was gone. That told me that something was going on in her camp. Because as much as she would kind of, you know, make mistakes and be late or whatever, she always made good on it later. She's a nice person. She's a nice human being. But she made a lot of mistakes, but she would make good on it. You know what I mean? It's sure. Like people make mistakes, but once I had to chase the cake, I was gone and I never looked back.
Yeah, because you're working harder on a gig like that than normal, just to get above surface level.
You know, the mistake that we make sometimes as musicians is we equate how many people we're playing for and the stature of the artist with our career success. And when you're playing for, you're playing in a soccer stadium, you're playing on TV, you're feeling like, yeah, this is it. You know, my career's set. And you don't look at all the BS that comes with it sometimes. So it took me a while to see through it and bail, but that was one of my smarter decisions, was getting out.
That's interesting. So you're playing in the – okay, I totally get what you're saying. You're looking at the pomp and circumstances and mistaking that for, like, financial benefits or career acceleration.
Well, even the dough was decent. I mean, she paid in cash, but you just – it's your ego. Yeah. It's your ego going, you know, it's better for me to play in front of 20,000 people than to play a small jazz gig in a club. Well, not always. If you keep doing that same pop gig and you keep playing the same music over and over, you never grow.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So go ahead. Sorry about that.
Oh, I mean, that's okay for some people. Some people love that. To me, the cats that I've always admired and the way I've always felt are people that wanted to keep learning and keep getting better at what they do, not do the same thing over and over, not follow, you know, which, again, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't fault anybody for that. But for me,
yeah,
personally, you know, I like to play something different.
I think a lot of people agree with you. I've interviewed several guitar players that I could think of off the top of my head that were playing in pretty major acts and left for that reason. You know, it's like, hey, the bread was good, the treatment was good, but I'm literally playing the exact same set list night after night for a year. And we had a new album out. It was the exact same set list. And it was just, I couldn't handle it anymore. So I've heard that a couple of times, man.
Oh, I see acts where they're playing the same set list 5 years later. They're just rehashing the oldies and wow, I couldn't do it. But you know, if people can do it and they can make the music feel good, more power to them.
Sure, man. Wow. Another interesting one, Gary Richrath from REO.
I'm full of the funny stories. This is another one. When REO and Gary split, Gary actually had the deal. He had the record deal. He did a lot of the songwriting. Kevin did too, Cronin. They're all nice guys, but whatever, they split for whatever reasons. And it was my first bus tour. This was before I even got with Mark Bonilla and those people. Pretty sure it's before then. My timeline is not the greatest. But the Reader's Digest is Gary still played great, but he just couldn't stop drinking.
Right.
And the only time he would be sober is right before he played. And he'd be sober for the gig or if you were going to play basketball. So he started having the wrong people around him. And one of them is the singer, who was a complete tool. And the singer brought his drug dealer guy to be the tour manager.
God.
And Gary's not aware of it. And, you know, I'm not aware of it. I don't really know these guys. I just pop on the bus tour, you know. And I'm noticing.
Wait a minute, so this is with REO or is this with Gary solo after?
This is Gary solo.
Okay.
Stuff. When they split and I'm in the bus and I'm having to threaten to get my money every week from this tour manager guy. Like, look, if I don't get my cake, I'm going to have to bail, blah, blah, blah. And he'd begrudgingly, you know, count out hundreds, which, you know, whatever.
Have you had that a lot? Has that happened a lot?
Yeah.
I mean, is that not you? Is that a standard thing that every musician has to deal with? Because that seems fucking ridiculous.
I think on your way up, it does. And I think even when you're established, I think what happens is managers, especially when they're new, they want to justify their existence. So they want to cut costs and they want to show the artist how it's cheaper. So what they do is they say, you know, you're paying the band too much. It's always the first ones. It's always the people that actually create the music that get screwed the most. Sorry, I don't want to go on that rant. But it's pretty much how it is. And you just have to learn as you're coming up that you got to speak up. And if somebody has a reputation for not paying, there's probably a reason.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to try to not pay you. So, you know, if something smells like a turd, it usually is.
Yeah.
You know, it's what it is. But when you're coming up as a player and when you need cash, even when you're not coming up, if you need dough and you're not working, you'll sometimes fall in the wrong camp. This is like the beginning. I mean, really the beginning of my career. But it ends in a funny story. I'm noticing that they're changing buses all the time. I'm going, that's really weird. And I had met a guy named Sandy Stein in L.A., big, burly, you know, kind of a, how do I put it? Let's just say he had connections, Jewish kind of, I mean, big, scary guy.
Hmm.
You know, I think Sandy must have been 6'3 or 6'4. I haven't talked to him in years. Had a baseball bat sitting in his office.
Nice.
And he coordinated a lot of bus tours. And I called him. I said, hey, man, what's going on? He goes, oh, the guys you're out with are not paying their bill every week. That's why they're changing buses.
Oh, so they're just hiring a new bus that doesn't know their previous history. Say, oh, we need a bus.
Right.
Holy shit. It's like moving from one place to the next when you're not paying your rent or something like that.
That's exactly it. Except there's no internet back then for people to know.
Yeah.
And he said, you need to get off this quick because something's going to happen. I said, okay, well, I got to pay off a few more things. So I waited a little too long and I wake up a week later and I hear a lot of noise and I look out the window of the hotel and I see the bus going down the road with the trailer and the guys in the band and the tour manager chasing after the bus in their bare feet. And they're boxers because people – you move into the bus, right?
Yeah, so all their shit
was
in
there. You get your day rooms and once in a while you get one to sleep. This was a sleep place. So they took the bus with everybody's gear.
And, oh, my God.
And it went south for a little while. But, I wound up bailing. But what's interesting is that everybody kind of gets theirs in the end. You know, the – tour manager guy, someone beat him to near death with a brick, one of the guys on the tour that he didn't pay. And he's somewhere in another country gone. The singer's been hiding out ever since then. I mean, that was their one little hurrah. And, you know, I survived. Another one of the guys survived. And we both had kind of nice careers. Gary was a lovely guy. He just drank too much, honestly. And he didn't keep an eye on his business, but what a tone.
Yeah. He's a great player. It's interesting. The music business is a very small, community. You don't think
I agree. It is. And it isn't, I think it's very clicky. And I think that, if you go, the world of rock music and classic rock is a small world. Yes, because it's one community. And then you go to the world of like maybe death metal. And that's a small community.
Yeah.
But those guys don't know each other.
Yes.
And then you go over to old school R&B. And those guys, small community. But when you get in the big picture, and that's how a lot of people get over. Their way through one style, and when they burned all their bridges there and everybody's found out they're an imposter, then they go on to the next style. And they talk their way onto gigs and they get through that. And I've seen it time and time again. It's kind of pathetic, but it is what it is.
Interesting. Within the communities, though, it's very – like you're not more than 1 or 2 degrees of separation from anybody in there from knowing this one to get to that one.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy actually.
But that is true because I've interviewed guys and gals in so many different genres, and you're right. You know, the bluegrass guys don't know the metal guys. The metal guys don't know the jazz guys who don't know the country guys who don't know it's a very accurate statement what you said. It's little communes or little communities, I think is a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Keith Emerson.
Nicest guy. Unbelievable player. Some of the first rock music I heard was that. I was like, wow, keyboards can be the lead. Playing with Mark, actually, Bonilla, he put together this super group with everybody super except me. I'm the one guy that nobody knew. I'm the side session guy.
Yeah, I don't know about that, man.
Oh, yeah, especially at that time. It was Keith, Ronnie Montrose, Bissonette, who else was in it? I want to say it was Mick Mahan on bass. I don't know who else was in it, but Keith was the other keyboard player. And as my mom used to say, you're too dumb to be afraid. That's me. I was too dumb to be intimidated.
Dude, that's great.
Yeah, he was a lovely guy. He let me play, and he had a whole shit ton of funny stories, and definitely had quite a few adult beverages together on the road. He wound up being my drinking buddy. We drink white wine with water in it. I just didn't get it. Something weird.
That is weird. No, that's funny, man. What a band, though. Wow.
Yeah, Keith was so not what you would think. You know, he looks like, you hear that music and you think it's going to be some kind of pompous guy. He was the most down-to-earth, regular guy, wanted to ride motorcycles, go jet skiing, water skiing, you know, fly a plane, have a couple of adult beverages. That's what he was. He was the just a regular cat that just loved life.
Very cool. Yeah, that was a tragic loss, man.
His hand was a mess.
His hand?
Yeah, that had a lot to do with it, and he had a lot of pressure on him. He was on different meds at the time, and he was still drinking a little bit, and I think it was just a bad combination of factors, and I think that he had a little bit of a heart problem on top of all of that. So it was just a perfect storm, and I think some of these anti-depression medicines actually make people suicidal, and I think we've seen that.
Yeah. Well, I think the issue is, I think they may know what one might do, but most people are not on one, man. They're on this and that. And, oh, by the way, you got to take this because this combination is going to give you high blood pressure. Oh, and then your, you know, fucking heartbeat's going to go up. So make sure you take this to keep it down. You know, it's like, come on, man. You're fucking with hormones.
That's exactly right. I mean,
you know, that's the most. That runs your body, man. That's, you know, you can't do that shit without consequences.
You know, the thing to say about Keith, whether you liked his music or not, you always knew it was him.
Yeah.
He had such whatever. And I saw him sit in on things, and I saw him do TV things where he's playing music that totally has nothing to do with Emerson, Lake and Palmer or classical or prog or jazz. And he still sounded like you. Oh, that's Keith Emerson. You just knew it.
Yeah, that was a tragedy, man. Sorry, I'm just taking a note here. Okay, you mentioned Rob Halford before. What did you do with Rob? That's talk about a guy who's been around the block, man. Super talented guy.
You know, I want to say I did 4 albums with him. I'm not sure. I'd have to look. Roy Z connected me with him. I think the first one I did, I want to say it was Crucible. And talk about a guy that's not what you think he is. Lovely guy. But you look at this guy and he's got on the biker garb, you know, and he's got all the studs. And I'd done all this work for him in the past and I'd never really met him. Hmm. And Z was like, you know, Rob really wants to meet you and work with you and do some co-writes on this record. And I'm thinking, this is going to be great. Dude's going to ride in on a motorcycle. Maybe he's going to have a cape and he's going to have all the leather on. And in comes this totally soft-spoken gentleman. He's wearing Gap shorts and a little cap. You know, a Banana Republic t-shirt.
That's,
you know,
hilarious, man.
Soft-spoken gentleman. Just a total pleasure to work with.
That's cool.
Not man. At all. I mean, I'm thinking, you know.
Yeah.
That's your thought, and when he gets on stage, he does it.
Right, right.
But just a quiet cat. Very cool.
It's a great writer, man. Really talented guy.
Oh, yeah.
You did work with George Johnson and the Brothers Johnson. Talk about a great R&B band, man.
Oof. That band was one of the bands that I heard all the time when I was a kid. Didn't know I was listening to them, and as I got older, I realized, I learned a ton from George. Brilliant producer, writer, guitar player. I mean, even just showed me how to play the wah-wah a different way. George has a different kind of thing and just a great writer. And, you know, I've been lucky enough. I've been with George since 2001.
Oh, that's crazy. Dude, that's like 100 years in the music business, maybe 200 years.
And I think by 2006, I was MD, something like that. We don't play as much. He's had some health issues, and Lewis died a few years ago. And George has been through kind of hell, but really, really a fun guy. And he's got a lot of insight. He's got some crazy theories, but some of them are so spot on. You're just like, wow.
About the music business or about life or?
Just, yeah, life and everything else, you know. I mean, this is going to sound like a weird one to say coming from a Latino Jew, but one of the things George pointed out is, like, I know you love R&B music, and you got to remember, if you look at those lyrics, those are not lyrics for like country white people. These are lyrics for black people and their real problems and what their life is about. And you look at it, it's like, oh yeah, that's what it is. But you don't think about it until, you know, it's one of a lot of things that George opened my eyes to, that it's out there, but you just don't think about it. So, you know,
but I think that's true of every, you know, every music that's kind of like, wherever it is, you know, if it's like metal, it's probably some white guy in Long Island or something like that writing, you know, about, you know, he's frustrated by his parents' expectations of him, you know. If it's the blues, it's somebody white or black talking about, you know, shit's not fair, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like if you're listening to rap from Compton, it's not a white dude that wrote it.
No.
You know? And
they reflect the problems and the joys and the life of that person that wrote it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't have any issues with that at all. I mean, you know, this is a, thank God that different people write different shit, you know, that it's not all the same stuff. It gives everybody choices, variety. You know,
yeah.
I don't have any issues with that. I don't think, God, if it gets to the point where now you're offended because the music, and it might.
It might,
you know, how could you write those lyrics? It doesn't appeal to everyone. How dare you? You know, I hope that doesn't happen. God almighty. But yeah, that's cool that you were with George that long. Let's talk about, I don't know if you can even do this. Is there a way for you to, like, it doesn't have to be exactly accurate, top three musical experiences you've had?
Ooh.
For any reason, you know, any reason at all.
Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of good ones. You know, since we're talking about George, I worked with George and his son, Troy, who's a top flight producer, years and years ago on a flip of Land of Ladies in the studio. And I had so much fun working with George in there. So that's definitely going to be one. I've been really fortunate. A lot of the times that I had with Ronnie playing Montrose, playing fusion and jazz is such a joy to me because it's so free and you never have to play the same thing twice. You know, you're just free. And when you're with the right guys, and Ronnie had such a great band, Jimmy Paxson on drums, a guy named Myron Dove on bass, really had a lot of fun doing that.
I still listen to the his old stuff with Sammy singing, Sammy Hagar. And that stuff was just classic. Great rock and roll, man.
You know, you're gonna chuckle. When I met Ronnie, I didn't know any of that music.
Really? No. How could you know everything? You know, it's not possible.
Well, I knew Ronnie as this guy who, as a session player, who had played with Tony Williams in Lifetime.
Right.
Who played with Herbie Hancock. He recorded with him. Who recorded and played with Van Morrison. Did that Tupelo Honey record. I thought of him as this fusion guy.
Interesting.
And then I'm finding out different. I'm like, oh, okay. So you had this whole rock thing that you did too. Well, that kind of makes sense. Okay. But yeah, I had a blast working with him. I did the rock fusion. We did, acoustic tours. I did a whole bunch of them with him over the years. I learned a lot. That was one of those make a smart decision. It was a pop artist that I could have played with for twice the money. And I took that gig and I took Ronnie's gig instead. And I never looked back.
You, the longevity you have with people, I mean, says a lot about A, how easygoing you are to get along with, but B, the value that you add to what you're doing, man, because I don't need to tell you, you don't see that. That's not really the norm, let's say. Especially years ago where you have this massive selection and massive pool and it's nothing to, you know, pull out one from column A and bring back one from column B and, oh, let's get the other one from column. You know, that says a lot about you, man.
Oh, thanks. I've been really fortunate. You find a few people that you work for and they like the particular thing that you do. I mean, we all have something that we do that's special, and or we hope we do.
Yeah.
And you want to hope that who you're working for recognizes that. Because you can be the nicest guy in the world, but then they're going to invite you over for the barbecue. They ain't going to call you to play on a record.
Right, right.
Or do the shows. I mean, you can't be a total tool because then nobody's going to work with you. But you have to be lucky. I mean, some of the people I work with or have worked with, I stayed with so long. Sophie B. Hawkins, I was with a long time, and I still talk to her. And I feel lucky. She likes what I do. She likes that I play real freely. That's how she calls it. You know, that it's that really. It's a lot of luck and timing to go with being able to play.
But you said something a couple of times, and I think you have something to do with this, and the fact that it seems like, or I get the feeling you take a lot of time, or not take a lot of time. You don't just say yes. I mean, in the beginning, you took whatever you needed to do. But as your career, you sound like you have an evaluative process where you're saying, do I do this? You know, what's the opportunity cost financially? What's the opportunity cost professional growth-wise? So you have some I mean, you have to, you know, you're to be responsible for some of that good fortune as well, because you thought it through and said, hey, is this a fit for me?
You know, I'd love to take a lot of credit for that. Here's how I really think of it. I think it goes back to the community thing. And because I got out of the pop community, I don't get those calls. And also because I play a certain way. People, this is in no means a derogatory thing, but certain gigs require different things. Is a nice way of putting it. In other words, certain gigs, you got to really be able to stretch, and other gigs, when you stretch, it's a liability. They don't want you. Oh, you play jazz? Oh, no, I'm not interested in calling you.
Right.
So I think what happens is people kind of know what you do, and they scout it out. And, you know, sometimes you'll get an odd call. Like, I got a call from actually Whitesnake a few years ago. And it was because he had done a Deep Purple record, and they had.
You say he? You mean Coverdale?
Yeah, David. Yeah, very nice guy, actually. His MD, I think it was Reb Beach, had checked out stuff I had done on the internet, and my buddy Doug Aldrich was with him before. And in the end, I wound up doing Shuggie Otis instead. And they wanted more of a singing keyboard player, because I think David, as he's gotten older, trying to sing way up there is a little harder.
Sure.
So he wanted a stronger guy. But the reality was, the Shuggie Otis call was from someone that was close to me, James Manning, that knew exactly what I did and said, hey, man, I got a gig that you're perfect for.
Okay.
It's Shuggie Otis. You know, it may get a little crazy. It was a guy that really knew me and knew what I did. So hopefully you're not going to be upside down forever here.
That's not good, man.
That knew what I did, and it all made sense. We're going to be upside down. Hopefully I'm. Am I
no,
upside down?
No, not at all, man.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd love to say I'm the sharp, forward-thinking guy, but I'm somebody that's just kind of always loved playing music so much that if it's a gig that I'm going to love the music on, I'll generally go do it. And if I'm not going to, I won't do it. It's not I haven't really plotted a career path carefully. Otherwise, I think I'd probably be a little further along with my solo career by now. But, you know, I don't have any regrets, really.
You said you grew up in D.C. Did you have, like, brothers and sisters you grew up with, or were you only child? Or
I had an older sister. You know, I just kind of went my own way a little bit when I was growing up. My mom was sick for a while. And once I started playing music, I started doing all kinds of sports. And once I started playing music, once I got the bug, it's kind of all I wanted to do. wound up going to college for something that had nothing to do with music, just to kind of make my parents happy, and kind of lost 4 years, to be totally honest. But yeah.
Where'd you go to school? What'd you take up?
It's called Rice University. It's
in Texas. Texas. Yeah.
I originally, before I got into music, I was playing a lot of baseball, and I couldn't hit a slider. That's kind of what kept me out of really playing ball at a college level. That's really the big difference between high school and then college and pro is a huge step up. And it's really the slider and a split finger fastball. I couldn't see it.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
That helped me get into Rice. They had a big baseball team a little bit. And I think my father knew somebody that maybe he greased somebody. I don't know. And also that I was playing so much music. It was so predominant. I was playing in a community college jazz band. I couldn't read music, but I was playing in the local jazz band there. And I was pretty much playing every weekend by the time I was 15 in clubs. So I think that probably helped. I don't know. I'm still not sure how I got into that school or even how I got out, but somehow I made it, and I was playing clubs the whole time in Houston while I was there.
Now I understand. I had a question in the back of my head. How the hell did Texas ever come into the equation? But Rice, now I get it. And that's in Houston, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it's right in the middle.
Yeah. What was your dad in education or something? Is that what made you go to school?
No, my dad was one smart guy. He was an MD that worked for the VA hospitals. He never practiced as a doctor. It's probably where I got my "I just want to do what I want to do" from. He worked for the National Institutes of Health later, and he was a brilliant guy. But he was a real just direct, no BS straight shooter, and I think, you know, he was like, "Yeah, you can pursue whatever you want, but please go to college at least for a minute."
All right.
I think people have these weird hang-ups about their parents, you know, in the wrong way when parents don't support their career, their little career choice or whatever their whim is at the time. I think the reality is parents just want the best, what they think is the best for their kids.
Sure.
And, you know, if someone has a good life doing one thing, they're going to say, well, you know, we've got it easier than that generation. That generation couldn't make choices. They had to, you know, whatever was available to them as a job and education line, they took it.
Yes. You
know, they did what they had to do. And now it's a little easier. So but in their mind, at least, I'm sure my father was going, well, look at what a great life I've had. He should follow the path that I followed, and then he's going to have the same great life. You know, and he's looking at music and going, I mean, people look, you're going to be a musician. Everybody told me I was going to fail. Everybody everywhere.
Did that motivate you more? Are you the kind of person, because like it's the best way to motivate me is to tell me I'm not going to do something.
Maybe a little. The things that I've learned to calm down. The things that used to get me was disrespect or not paying me. I would feel like if you don't pay me for a gig, you're disrespecting me, and I would be a knucklehead. Back in the day, I took guitars and microphones, squab with an entire band. You know, I was that idiot that I couldn't let shit go. I've learned to let things go. But maybe to some extent, you know, I never had a bad relationship with my family. I loved them. But, you know, I happened to go to Texas and I realized that I love playing music. And I think it's funny when I went back, when my parents died, when my mom died, was the second one to go, I went through boxes of stuff and saw report cards. And they all said the same thing. You know, he's really artistic and he has a music talent. And he's, you know, he's motivated by this. And I never saw that stuff.
You know?
And then I talked to my aunts and uncles, and, you know, a lot of them are gone now. I have two left in Brazil. But they would all say, yeah, music would come on and you would just brighten up. You would turn into something else. even when you could barely walk, you would start dancing when music played. So I think they probably knew, and you know, they probably weren't happy at first, but they just, you know, they just let me make it on my own, which at the end of the day, you feel good about it.
Yeah. When
you do it yourself, you did it yourself. You can say it. You don't have to say it. You just feel a different kind of calm and a different kind of peace.
Well, you own it, man, and it's yours, and you don't owe anybody. And that, I mean, that's a good, I mean, I enjoy that feeling of not owing somebody something.
Well, we're all serious. We need another funny story, because that's what life
is. Yeah, man. Let me, is there any advice, if you, looking back, what anything advice you would have told yourself that would have made things easier for you?
You know, one of my friends is a retired studio keyboard player, played on I don't know how many thousand albums, Clarence McDonald. When I met him, you know, a drummer that was playing with him, I guess, told him, hey, you need to check this guy out, Ed Roth, blah, blah, blah. And he brought him over to my studio while I'm trying to record a solo, a jazz solo, really sensitive ballad. So, totally threw me off my game, but we got to be friends. And as we're getting to be friends, I kept asking Clarence, I said, hey, man, you know, share something with the younger generation. You know, show me some licks, show me some turnarounds. You have all this cool church shit. And he would always say, oh, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. You're fine. And then one day he said, you know, I am going to give you some advice. You got to learn how to let go of things. You got to let go of grudges. You got to let go of whatever people, when there's shit around you, just smile and move away from it. You know, let go. Don't try to get revenge. I know it's hard to do, but that stuff winds up hurting you more than it hurts anyone else.
Very true.
And it's not like I was some kind of angry guy or anything. But sometimes, you know, you get caught up in day-to-day stuff, and I still do. But I've really learned how to let go. I think not getting bogged down in the little day-to-day bullshit of the music business and trying to look at a long-term goal and just try to be the best player you can. Play all kinds of music. And don't be distracted by shiny objects, as they say. Don't worry about that the other guy has the pop gig that doesn't play as well as you do. You know, don't worry about what other people are doing. Don't worry about what other people are making. Just, if you love music, if you truly love it, it's the right career for you. If you truly love it and you'll work at it and you have some kind of aptitude, you will make a living. It's when you start not loving it and you start plotting and scheming and planning and being envious of other people's things. And I think I'm lucky in the sense that I never had that personality. And I think that's helped me be successful. Everybody's jealous, you know, and they tell you not to in the Bible, but everybody envies other people's things, whether they like it or not. It's the ability to tell yourself, hey, that has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think it's kind of an important thing that if you have that and then you just focus on what you love doing, I think it comes together. And I think people are going to look at this and go, he's completely full of shit. You know, I'm working at Domino's Pizza driving. Yeah. Obviously you got to take the steps. You got to get out there.
Right. Right.
You got to be part of the scene. You know, you can be the best player if no one hears you. I think here's the advice I would give after that long rambling.
No, man, it's good. It's not a fucking exam, man. We're just chilling.
Yeah, here's what I would say. Play on gigs where what you do the special is allowed to shine.
Yeah.
And that's something that's taken me years to figure out. And maybe 10 years ago, I figured it out. If I can't play, if I can't do what I do on this gig, I don't want to be on this gig. If I'm just sitting there playing parts and there's nothing that I have that's special to bring to the gig, then I'm not going to be able to play what I want to play. I'm not going to move up. You know, I'm not going to raise my game. My ability is not going to increase. So maybe that would be the one. Pick a gig where you can shine on that gig. You know, a simple pop gig, I'm not going to shine.
Right.
That's the reality. Playing the same part over and over every night, and I don't jump around as well as some of the other cats, and I don't play standing up. But what I shine at creating parts and doing studio work and accompanying a singer and improvising and playing with dynamics. If those elements aren't on a gig, I should not be on that gig. And I think that's what you have to do as a player. When you get to a point where you know who you are, you have to do that.
Man, I'm going to say that again out loud because I think that's such great advice for any musician. You said play on gigs where what you do is special and allows you to shine. That's a win-win for everybody, man. That is really smart.
Thanks.
Hey,
took me a long time to figure it out.
Yeah, but you know, I know certain shit takes a long time and it only takes a minute to implement though. You know, it's like it gets spent 50 years trying to figure out the message and it's like, oh, I got it. Okay, no big deal. And it's like, what? Why did this take so? Why, you know, it's just like sometimes you're ready.
You know, the one other one I would say is there's some book. Some guy's like, if you do something for 10,000 hours, you're great, blah, blah, blah. Sounds like bullshit. The reality is if you keep doing something, you start getting good.
Yeah.
Unless you're just a complete M.O. Ron, you're going to start getting better. If you challenge yourself and you keep doing stuff, you're going to get better. You hit a certain number of hours and it becomes easy all of a sudden.
I think it's Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know which one of his books. It's not Blink because I read that one, but it's. I think it's pretty sure it's Malcolm Gladwell. Hey, man, Desert Island Discs. Oof. Pick some Desert Island Discs for me.
Immediately, Miles Davis kind of blew. I know it's the most commercial jazz album out there, but you know what? It is so musical and melodic. They go inside and outside in all the right places. You know, it's the textbook maybe of modal jazz. I don't know the terms for it. I'm Mr. Self-Taught, so that's one. There's a bunch here. There's a couple Crusaders records I think I couldn't live without. Joe Sample's such a wonderful player. There's some Zeppelin that you can't live without going over into the rock world. There's some Beatles. And there's really a lot of truly great music. I didn't play on any of them, so I can say it. Some of the early Brothers Johnson stuff is just brilliant. That's George Duke on a lot of that, playing keys. A little bit of Billy Preston is another one.
Yeah, that guy's a badass.
It's a hard one to kind of narrow that one down. There's so many great records. There's some Thelonious Monk that you don't want to live without. There's some Stones. I mean, the Stones used Sonny Rollins on sax on, what is it, Waiting on a Friend, which is maybe one of their later records.
Yeah.
Not anybody's favorite. I love like Heartbreaker and that kind of stuff.
That's great stuff.
But that solo, the Sonny Rollins solo, and the idea to use Sonny Rollins on that song, devastating.
Do you remember the video for that? It was so cool. It was like Sonny playing in the street, I think underneath a subway station or up on the roof. It was up on the rooftop, I think it was.
Really? I never saw the video.
It was good. I hear the solo like it was yesterday. That was such a good solo, man.
Yeah, that guy, wonderful player. That's a hard one. I would be hard pressed on a desert island. A lot of stuff.
Someone answered that question. Do you happen to know an English guy named Guy Pratt, bass player?
I know the name. It seems like somehow I know him. I don't know how.
Well, he lived in L.A. for quite a while, so you might have known him from that. He said to me yesterday. I think I was talking to him the day before, and he said, you know, the years ago, the question would be, give me your top three Desert Island discs. Now it's, give me your top 30,000 songs to fit on this little hard drive.
Ooh.
You know? So yeah. It's times have changed, man.
Yeah, really changed.
Hey, what's the best decision you ever made, Ed?
To be a musician, to do it full time. That would be it. That would be it, to dive in. I mean, like I said, that's maybe the other bit of advice. Don't be discouraged. I remember, I'm not going to say the guy's name because I don't want to call him out. There's a studio that I was working at doing a fair amount of sessions. Not a lot, but a fair amount. But I wasn't an A-list guy by any stretch of the imagination. I was like the C-list guy. You know, they called the A-list guy, he couldn't do it. The B-list guy came in, or maybe I was fixing something. And one day the guy calls me into his office and he's like, you know, you seem like a really nice guy. You're a hell of a musician, but you know, everybody fails out here. I'm like, where are you going with this?
Yeah.
Says, you know, you were making a good living back in Texas. I heard you should go back there. You're probably, you know, on top of the scene and, wow, and you that- probably really do great. And I just went, so this is the advice you're giving me? Have a good day. Years later, the guy's sold the studio and he's calling me to produce his son's record. So I got a little chuckle out of it. I was thinking, and I reminded him, I was like, hey, you know, remember when, and now I'm still in the business and I'm up in my house. What are you doing? You're not in the business anymore, are you? You're running rental properties. Is that what it is? So that's an example of me not letting go of things and not following Clarence's advice.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
The point there is just everybody's going to tell you it's not going to happen, and other musicians will be around complaining about the conditions on the gig and how you should be getting paid more, and the food isn't good on the gig, and you know, why didn't they give me a window seat instead of an aisle seat? Yeah, I get it, but just put your head down and keep going.
Yeah, you're getting to play music every day for a living.
Yeah. Appreciate how good we have it, first of all, in the U.S.
Yeah.
And then how good we have it doing something we love to do. And yeah, don't let anybody step on you, but don't let it ruin your day.
Dude, I'm going to ask you a very difficult question that you are not going to want to answer. And if you don't want to answer, that's cool. What do you like most about yourself? Do you know Adam Zimmern is by any chance? Guitar player? Cool. Adam Zimmern. I asked him. He's a really nice guy. He plays with Ziggy Marley, and he's like our age. And I asked him that question. He's got the best answer from everybody I've ever asked it. He goes, "How can I answer that question when I have so much self-loathing?"
That's a good answer. That's really good. If I'm going to play with him, I'm gonna ask him. My buddy's been playing percussion with him for years.
With Ziggy.
Yeah.
So Adam's on that gig. Yeah.
I mean, the only way I can answer that, you know, I mean, I'll say what I found out. Montrose was a really dear friend, and I'm very close to his widow now. I see Lisa a lot. She's a beautiful person and went through a lot. And she told me a couple things that, you know, it's kind of like we never told each other certain things we probably should have, Ronnie. And I just, you know, just general friendship shit that we could have vented maybe. We just had a lot of respect for each other. I certainly had a lot of respect for him anyway. And I think one of the things that we struggle with as musicians is somehow you feel like you're going to be found out. Like you're really faking it. Certain guys that play a certain way that are not educated musicians, like Ronnie was not an educated musician. He just played by feel. And somebody like me, who is also not educated, people will ask me, "Hey man, those are great chords, or those are crazy chords. What are you playing?" And I say, "I don't know." And I look at them and I go, "Well, you know, we got a flat 13 here and a flat 7, whatever, you know." I try to analyze it, but I just kind of play, and you just kind of wonder if there's people out there who are just going to go, he doesn't know what the fuck he's playing, and he's a complete imposter. So that's one place I find it hard to say anything. I guess what I like about myself, I don't always do the right thing, but I try to, you know, in life. I try to. I don't intentionally go out of my way to screw with anybody, to do something nasty. You know, I'm not a nasty person. And I think, I know that sounds like a pathetic thing to say about something you like about
yourself. Oh my God, dude, you're so rough on yourself.
But that's we all aspire, I think, to do the right thing. And I think as you get older, you get more sympathy for people because you look at what situation, what position life has put them in, and they'll do some things that are maybe not nice. You know, there aren't that many genuinely nasty people, and I'm just glad I'm not one of them. I'm sure I do some bad things, and I know I've done plenty of bad things in my life that I'm not proud of, but I like that I try not to.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's all I can honestly aspire to, you know?
I'll tell you something very funny, ironic about your answer. That same Guy Pratt, I think it may not have been the response to the same question. Now, this is a guy when Pink Floyd broke up and Roger Waters left. I think Tony Levin played the first album, and after that he couldn't play, and so he's been with Pink Floyd ever since. Since he did a couple of tracks on A Momentary Lapse of Reason. So that's like, I guess, late 80s or early 90s, and he's been with them ever since. He's Gilmore's bass player. He played with Brian Ferry. He played with Roxy Music. He's been around the block.
Wonderful career.
Yeah, really good. And, you know, he said to me, Craig, you know, somehow I always feel like I'm going to get found out. Like, verbatim what you said. And he goes, like, I think people, and he's the same, self-taught, right? And he goes, I feel like, and he goes, finally I'm kind of at a point in my career where I'm thinking, well, maybe I won't get found out, or maybe you know. It was, and this was like within the last 2 days. It was, and the way you said it and the way he said it was like, you're 95% similar, man.
You know, I just did a straight ahead jazz album, and some guys play jazz 100% of their life, and they're going to be way more authentic than me. And it's, you know, when it was coming out, I was like, what kind of reviews am I going to get? And thankfully, you know, the first couple of reviews are like really, really stellar. I'm thrilled. But I'm going to myself, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, you know, I mean, one of my best friends out here is a wonderful keyboard player, really great guy, Bill Steinway, who also helped my career, you know, really lovely guy. And Bill was going to jazz camp when he was 13.
Holy crap.
And I'm thinking, I wasn't that child prodigy. I mean, I started on drums when I was 11. So you go, well, how can I compete with that? And how can I compete with... And then you go, well, wait a minute. This is a national jazz record, and my competition are the number one guys in the world. That's who my competition is, whether I like it or not. Yeah. And you're worried because you're going, I don't know what I did on this record. You know, I came up with all these vamps. It's I like watching sumo, right? And those guys are like the most humble guys. At the end, they interview them, and they all say, you know, they say, what are your goals? Well, you know, I'd like to continue, keep winning and continue using my brand of sumo. And that's kind of how I feel about how I play. I want to just play my brand and hopefully people will like it. You know, that's what you do. And can somebody play faster than you? There's always someone that can play
faster. Oh, my God. Yeah, that's like saying, you know, are you the strongest guy in the gym? Are you the richest guy in your neighborhood? That's a ridiculous.
Yeah, you
can't worry about that stuff.
Yeah, you just got to do it. So I don't know. I've prattled on mindlessly. Hopefully I've answered some
questions. No, you're good, man.
Bits of the tangents.
I'm going to ask you three more questions, and I thank you very much for everything. Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Love cars. Don't really work on them anymore. But I still do love them. I just don't have much room for them. I just got an old Jag from the head of the new label that I'm on, that I love. It's just, you know, it's a car, but it's like my friend Niels Lozauer, that's a car guy. He's got the time and the garages. But I like cars. I still love sports. I got to get back into martial arts. It's been a minute. I boxed for a long time, but then, you know, you start worrying about your hand. I never had hand problems. I started having an elbow issue. So I started swimming. Strange enough, I love swimming.
No, that makes it's a great sport, man.
Yeah, I really love it. I mean, I'm trying to teach myself the butterfly from watching the guys on the video. I don't have like a serious hobby anymore. I mean, you're a homeowner. You know how it is. You're remodeling your home all the time. It's, you know, let's redo this bathroom. You know, that's not really a hobby. I don't know if that's
No, some people like doing that. Like I've had a couple of guys say they like redoing, remodeling their house. That's actually something that people, a lot of people do like.
My first house, I did everything on.
Really?
Did everything. Yeah. I took 6 months. I didn't tour probably because I didn't have enough money to pay guys. But freaking plumbing, electrical. The only thing I didn't do was the roof and the copper repipe and a little bit of pulling the electrical wires. And then the guy was nice enough to show me when I ran out of dough.
Well, that's cool.
How to do it. I mean, repairing subfloors, tile, cabinets.
Where'd you learn how to do all this?
And you know what? My hat's off to those guys that do that every day. That's a lot of work. Now, I happily pay a buddy of mine to do it, and it looks a lot better than the way I did it. But it is fun to do it, especially tile work.
Where'd you learn how to do all that?
And I just learned it on the fly. And my dad did a little bit when I was growing up. Hmm. I mean, my dad, I owe him a couple things, and one of them is a work ethic. I don't know whether it's genetic or I'm that guy that when I have a job, a particular job, I can't stop till it's done. Hmm. I'm that weird, you know, obsessive guy. And I have other weird obsessions. Like I don't like shaking people's hands anymore. I have something weird.
Really? Like OCD?
Yeah. It just started a few years ago.
So what would you do? Like if I bumped it, you know, if I ran into you, like fist pump, what would you do?
I try to do the fist pump, which is funny because it's I think it's the old Black Panther power salute, right? I think that's where it started.
I don't know. I never do that just because I feel like it's not manly. This is my own weird shit, right? Someone gives me their fist. I'm like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with that? You know, shake my hand or not. Now, yes, if it's an obsession thing like cleanliness, that I understand, but I just don't get the fist pump thing, man.
You know, it's not even a logical thing.
It doesn't seem real.
It just fell on me one day. Like I'm afraid of heights,
right?
You know, and just one day I was afraid of heights,
right?
You know,
right.
One day I had a handshake thing. So you know, it's a minor one. I used to have little. Various mental tics that I don't want to go into, but if that's all I got to deal with,
right.
This bump is, you know,
yeah,
man, we've appropriated so many things from Black culture that we've taken from them. One more thing, I guess, doesn't matter. I don't know how to look at it other than that. I mean, that's also a subject for another day.
Yeah. I hear you, man. That's funny. You know what's weird? I know a woman, as my wife has gotten older, she's gotten little weird things like that, like OCD related stuff that she never had before. And I'm just looking at her sometime like, babe, you know, whatever.
And it's not logical.
No, it's not. It's not.
You can't think it away. People right. say that I shrink away from like a buddy of mine had blisters on his hands and he wanted to shake hands. And he said, I was like, he imitated me. Back and the look on my face. I didn't even know I did it.
Right. Yeah. It is what it is, man. If that's the only quirk you have, great. It's not. man, this another tough question. Toughest decision you've had to make or most difficult thing you had to do?
I mean, the one that comes to mind is a personal family one. I just can't even.
No, that's totally cool, man.
I can't even get into. Let me think about this for a minute. You know, this isn't a particular one, but sometimes you're on a gig and the artist comes to you and says, I'm going to fire the whole band except you and I want to make you DMD and the guys are all your buddies.
Oh.
So then
you have to do the firing?
I'm sorry?
And you're the guy who has to do the firing?
Well, he says, if you don't fire him, I will. You know, that happened to me once. And I actually managed to talk him into letting me keep all the guys but one.
Wow.
And the guy that was the MD, to his credit, had so much class that when I told him what was happening, he didn't blink. He just said, hey, man, thanks for looking out for me. So that was kind of a funky one. I mean, there's a lot of times. I mean, one of the Maricela times, we were she didn't show up for a gig, and we were working for a really minor player, cartel guy, but still a pretty scary dude. And I tried to get everybody to stick together, and a couple guys like crawled under the fence and took off. And it was dealing with that guy was pretty it was pretty creepy. What happened basically, the tough decision was everybody wanted to just get out of town. They heard that she was not coming the next day. Basically, we got taken to his club instead of to our hotel straight from the airport, and we got locked in. And he had a crew of guys that was going to rough us up.
Holy shit.
It wasn't him. He had a whole crew of guys in there. And a tour manager who was fearless. I mean, whenever I hear stereotypes about gay, this guy was gay, may he rest in peace, and he was fearless. Danny Siqueiros was afraid of nothing. Nothing would scare this guy. So he squared off with this is a smuggler in the office, and they're kind of going at it, and I hear it, and I come in, and he says, we're going to call, you know, we're going to call her brother, and he's on the phone with the brother, and he's like, yeah, I got one of your band guys in here. I'm going to shoot him. He's referring to me.
Holy crap.
And I'm just like, I don't think he's going to shoot me, but it didn't seem like it was going to end well. So he says to me, why don't you talk to this guy? Because I'm not making any progress with your guy here. So the brother was stupid enough to start yelling at me about what I don't know, and I lost it. And at that point, the smuggler realizes, you know what? These guys don't have anything to do with this. They're just getting screwed.
Oh, okay.
At that point, he goes, you know what? He hangs up the phone. He says, now I know what's happening. You guys are fine. I apologize. He tells us what his guys are there for. He's like, I apologize for what was going to happen. You probably had an idea. Let me order some breakfast. We're going to cancel the show for tonight. Do you think she's on for tomorrow? And of course, everybody says she's on for tomorrow. Well, here's where the funky decision came. The next morning, I get a wake-up call from the tour manager. Hey, we got to go to the airport. She's not coming. We got to get out of town before this guy figures it out. And I said, listen, this guy is a scary dude, number one. And number two, when we were straight with him, he didn't do anything to us.
Yeah, you can't go do that.
Well, I said, listen, we need to tell him what's going on. Everybody's like, no, you know, he's going to hold us. I said, you got to tell the guy what's going on. You have to do it. And it turned into a big, long, drawn-out argument. And finally, they went, okay, we'll call him. So they call him, and he says, okay, you guys are straight. You know, have a safe trip. We don't have any grudge.
Of course.
We get to the airport. We're trying to get on a flight. Guess who's there?
The guy.
The guy and one of his guys. No problems, you know, no drama or anything. He gets on the flight. Turns out he gets off the flight, and somehow he knows right where her mom lives and goes straight to her house, because what he wants is his deposit money back.
Sure.
And I guess the brother was, I don't know, he didn't have it or something, and he took off to Mexico to get away from this guy. So this guy calls the brother in Mexico and says, hey, someone wants to talk to you. Puts the mom on the phone.
Oh, my God.
So that's who we were dealing with. But the decision, you know, you're going, well, what do you do? I feel like if you try to do the right thing or what you think is right, the guy was straight with us. Granted, he's no angel. I mean, he's a dirty drug dealer. You know, there's no glamorizing that. There's no whitewashing it. But when we were straight with him, he didn't fuck with us.
Yeah.
So
That was kind of a little bit of a
holy
crazy
crap.
Decision.
Yeah, man. Wow. I'm surprised. That's amazing. You stuck that gig out. That is.
Yeah, it was pretty soon after I was gone, but you know, like I said, she had the wrong people around her. She's a good person.
She's still around?
Yeah, they're still doing it. She's kind of gotten it together when I hadn't seen her in almost probably 10 years, maybe a little more, and Danny died, the tour manager. And I went to the funeral, and only the music director was there. And I saw him. We hadn't talked in 10 years because it kind of got ugly in the end. And I hear someone behind me, you know, just crying uncontrollably. And I didn't look, and it's a woman. And then about halfway through, I feel a hand on my shoulder. I turn around. It's her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, the tour manager used to babysit her daughter. I mean, it wasn't like she wasn't a nice lady. She just got mixed up with the wrong things and the wrong people.
Wow. Holy crap.
Anyway, next. That was maybe one of the smarter decisions I made. Later.
Yeah. Last question, man. Ed, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional, and how much is just a fact, you know, a side effect of aging?
Mellowing out and letting go of things. Back
letting
to,
go. I like that, man.
Let go of stuff, not getting so, you know, not being that guy, oh, you're disrespecting me. Oh, you know, not being that guy, just going, you know what? It's not worth it. You figure out in life, you know, my dad gave me really good advice, but I didn't follow it for a while. He would say, don't get in a pissing battle with the skunk.
That is great.
And don't argue with the crazy person because you're not going to win. It's stuff like that. And the one that I'll use is don't try to teach anybody a lesson because they're not going to learn.
No.
Let somebody else teach them a lesson. Wherever it is.
Everybody learns.
Whatever stupid BS they're doing, get your money from them and be on your way. You don't need to teach them a lesson because it's not going to do any good. It's just going to burn your own house down.
Totally, man.
So maybe that would be that. And I think hopefully I have more compassion for other people and try to realize that people get in desperate circumstances and they do desperate things and that sometimes are not nice, and just chalk it up to that and move on.
Yeah,
have a little sympathy for their position, I guess. So hopefully I'm getting that way a little bit.
Well, good, man. That sounds like you're lightening your load.
It'll kill you if you don't.
Yeah, of course. Hey, man, first of all, I can't thank you enough for your time. I'm really glad I got to talk with you, and I appreciate you being so candid and open. And I want to tell people about your new record, and maybe you could talk about it a little bit. You got a new album out called Jazzland. Tell me about it.
All solo piano. You know, I started playing piano before I played keyboard or anything like that. I'm a piano player at heart, maybe that in B3, but even more piano and Rhodes and I started listening to jazz, really more bossa nova before anything else, but jazz, not knowing what it was. It's kind of returning to what I do, and it's my brand of sumo, as they say. It's my twist on these tunes, and it's not easy listening jazz, but it's not brain jazz either. It's just I played it as I felt, so far, people seem to really like it. So hopefully it's going to be that. It's a bunch of songs that you know and a bunch of jazz songs you don't know.
What's your favorite track on the record?
Probably Zingaro. It's a Jobim Bossa Nova. Eventually, they wrote lyrics for it and became Retrato in Branco y Preto. Portrait in white and black, but it bossa nova is it's got jazz, it's got unique harmony, and you really have to sing with the melodies you're playing.
It's got groove, man, too.
Oh yeah, that's the challenging thing about playing solo piano. It's got a groove more than you know. It's got a groove. It's got a swing somehow, which means something has, for something to swing, it's got to have something to swing against a little bit. So you've got to play the melody, you've got to make it swing, and you've got to establish some kind of harmonic structure. And it's just you. And then you've got to play it down, because the odds of punching something like that are, it's very difficult. I did it in a few little places here and there, but it's not easy to fix stuff solo piano. The pedal's in the wrong place, you know, playing exactly the right notes, the same velocity. You just hear it. So it, I'm really proud of it. You know, I thank the label for letting me do a jazz record first. This is a new label for me, and they had wanted me to do flips of rock covers, kind of done all weird and kind of jazz. And I said, hey, let me do standards first so people can see that I truly can play jazz.
Yeah.
Not some hack flipping stuff, and they let me do it. He goes, you got, what did you say? You got 3 weeks to get it done. I finished it in 16 days.
So good for you, man. That's a lot of work. Did you do?
Recorded in 16 days. The mix was another maybe 2-3 days.
So. Did you do all the engineering and the mastering?
Yeah.
Oh, you did? That's a lot of work, man.
Yeah, it's, you know, I got a couple buddies that helped me with mic placement and compression, but I didn't do much to it. The mic placement was so good. Ryan Hewitt, old buddy of mine that actually Chad Smith introduced me to, that has gotten me all kinds of session work, is just, dude's just a genius. He's just got it. Showed me how to position the mics, and I just stuck three mics up there, and honestly, the mixing was balancing them, and a little bit of compression, tiny bit of reverb, done.
That's awesome, man. Well, I want everybody to check it out again. It's called Jazzland by Ed Roth, and you can find it anywhere, you know, music is sold and streamed. And also, anybody that wants to get the benefit of having Ed play on their records and is looking for some remote sessions, he's done sessions for everybody. He was telling me before, and besides all the people I mentioned, he's done work with the Avett Brothers, Tom Morello, Brothers Johnson, Annie Lennox, Taylor Dane, Ronnie Montrose, Robbie Krieger, Keith Emerson, Glenn Hughes, Rob Halford, Chad Smith, Coolio. He's very well versed in the session world. And you can hook up with him on his website for that, which is called onlinekeyboardsessions.com. Again, it's onlinekeyboardsessions.com. And that's about it, man. Any other final words of wisdom or anything I missed?
Thanks for having me on it. You know, organic keyboards, they last forever. Piano and Hammond, the two things that you use the most in your studio, piano and Hammond.
I love it. Yeah, man, I love B3. Man, thank you. I appreciate everything. Everybody, thanks so much for listening. If you like this interview, share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate it. Thanks very much to Ed Roth for spending time with us. I really appreciate your time, Ed. Please support Ed's music and check out Jazzland and his other two records. His first one was called Ed Roth, and the second one, which is aptly titled, is The Mad Beatnik. I like that one, now that I know you a little better. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your keyboards, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.